Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is Maria Cornou. I was telling the other group that, in fact, my name is Maria Eugenia. Eugenia is like Eugenia for you. And as all in Latin America, we all are called Maria, you know. Yeah?
Yes,
it's a very Catholic tradition. And my mother is Spanish, so I come from that tradition. So she picked my name, Maria. And so we usually use our second name, just not to be as the rest of others. When I moved to the States, I became Maria because Eugenia is very difficult, the pronunciation. So this is part of the experience of being an immigrant. You have to reinvent yourself. You are not who you used to be. So this afternoon we are discussing, we have been with the other group, on bilingual worship, Spanish and English. But some topics could be interesting for even for other languages. How many of you are involved in any kind of bilingual worship service? Wow, that's good. So you have some, and my friend here, we shared lunch today, and they got a grant also for a bilingual worship service in North Carolina. So many interesting projects and ideas. So I will start with this phrase, it's not mine, but the idea of introducing bilingual liturgy is a little like introducing a new vegetable to toddlers. Huh? There are some kids that love it, but usually it takes time. It's a new flavor, it's something new. So I tried to find out good reasons to try. And I know that probably if you are here is because you are in certain ways engaged with the idea, but some churches need to be encouraged. Why? Should at least why to give a try? And I chose these three statements, real people saying why they love bilingual worship. And the first one says, it's a nice phrase, it's a foretaste of heaven. So we can always appeal to this motive that is biblical, historical, eschatological, the perspective that the church was born multilingual in Pentecostes. And if we go back to the Jewish tradition, we assume that in the first century Jewish worship were bilingual, Aramaic and Hebrew, the reading of the scriptures. And we all know how the church struggled with the idea of moving into the Greek world and how they have to make these decisions also to move into Greek, into Syriac, and then in the fourth century with again, another cultural change in language, the moving from Greek to Latin, and that there was a time where the Mass was done in the two languages, with Eucharist in Greek and the rest of the service in Latin after the translation into Latin of the scriptures. So we can always encourage others using this thing, or the biblical argument, reason, or the historical, and even eschatological. This is how we were born, in Pentecostes, multilingual. Through history, we have a lot of different cases of bilingual worship, successful bilingual worship. That is a way for the church to acknowledge changes in culture. And we are all invited to the wedding of the Lamb that will be a multicultural, multilingual event. The second motive or reason is this man saying, I love to be able to worship with others and see how they love God in their own way. And this is my interpretation of his statement. It's really good. But bilingual worship is more than just looking how other people do their stuff in their own way. It's joining them. It's experiencing something that is different. This is a bit stretched from us. But I call this the ecclesiological reason, because this makes us aware that we are a global church. We all have ethnocentrism. The Anglos and we Hispanics and other communities, we all tend to look at the world from our own place and our own culture. So this, it's a compromise. It's a way to understand that we are all part of the global church and to experience the nature, the real nature of the church. As it was said this morning, God chose for us to be a multicultural body. And the third phrase is someone, it's a young woman that said, I am bilingual. And this is how I think and how I was raised. I am at home in a place that had both languages, English and Spanish. And I call this a missional demographic reason. And I think that this is, well, this is part of the description of our workshop this afternoon. It's demographic change. It's a wonderful missional opportunity for us. So I love numbers. My first career is in accounting, so I always go to statistics. And just these are some numbers. According to the last national census, we are near 50 million Hispanics, and we are not so sure because, you know, with the undocumented population, some of them are not registered in the census. But we are about 50 million. And we had, there is an entire discussion on how to fill the census and race and all this stuff. But according to the information, the top five states, probably not a surprise, California, Texas, Florida, New York, and Illinois. Perhaps Illinois is not so expected. The other four, we very, very quickly identified Latinos or Hispanic population in that states. But the second is very interesting. The states with the fastest growing Hispanic population that are Tennessee, South Carolina, Alabama, Kentucky, and South Dakota. So what we are, and there are very interesting interactive maps done also by the Pew Research, where you can Google and click on your state and your county and your city, and you can see the numbers. But the Hispanic population, the Latino population, is moving into the country, looking after jobs, other opportunities. And even here, Western Michigan is becoming more and more Hispanic in certain spots, Holland, Michigan, and here in Kentwood, and this part of this. I did a research for the Worship Institute here, and we have a census of churches. We call churches. Some of them are small congregations in the garage or whatever. But in Kent County here, there are 70. There were 70 3 years ago, Hispanic churches. And the five states where Hispanics make the biggest share of the population are New Mexico, California, Texas, Arizona, and Nevada. So you can find really a growing Hispanic population almost all over the country, including Alaska. My husband traveled to Alaska and found a Mexican restaurant in a very small community. So.
I think they miss North Carolina. Don't you, Pastor?
It's growing very rapidly in North Carolina.
Probably these percentages is because these states were much below average in Hispanic population, and so the growth in terms of percentage is higher. So these are facts for us as churches, that our neighborhoods are changing, or will be changing, or could be changing. And it's not to scare anyone, but this is part. The United States is becoming more and more diverse. And there are other interesting, this is number one country destination for immigrants, not only Hispanics. And in 2014, the largest, if we consider single countries, not Hispanics as a broader categorization, the largest immigrant community in 2014 were Chinese, not Mexicans. So there will be more diversity coming. But going back to the Latinos, most Latinos are bilingual. This could be a bit tricky because the definition of bilingual has changed. Traditionally, bilingual was considered someone that was fully fluent in the two languages, like speaking like first language, the two of them. So now bilingual, the definition of bilingual has changed and is considered someone that is able to make sentences with meaning. Someone like me, I'm not fully bilingual, but I would be considered bilingual. So with this 70% are people that at least handle some level of, handle the two language with some level of fluency. But the bilingual group, even including bilingual first generation, but mostly when we say bilingual group, we are thinking just in the second generation, is the group that drives the demographic change. So until 2000, the largest group of, or the group that drive the demographic change were the immigrants, the new immigrants. Now this is changing. Numbers are changing, and the largest group that is growing is the bilingual, meaning the second and third generation. And we call them the bilingual, even when we speak some English, because we all know that second generation, usually, or first generation, but that came as little kids, very easily move into English as first language, but still keep Spanish. But the third generation usually lose Spanish or understand some basic Spanish. Some of them are passive. They can understand, but they answered in English. But this is the group that is growing. At we will experience this huge growth by 2050, the bilingual group. So, and we have the other phenomenon interesting for us as churches is the mixed families. Numbers of people with coming from two cultures will grow because first generation tend to marry inside the community. The immigrant community, but second and third generation usually tends to, in growing numbers, to marry outside the Hispanic community. Yeah.
Is there a point where immigrant communities that kind of go through this assimilation might even stop thinking of themselves as a Hispanic or Hispanic group in the same way that, for instance, like an Irish American might no longer think of themselves as an Irish American? They just they've lost connect with that.
Yes, it's a very good question. Some scholars and researchers say that as new immigrants are still coming, this in certain ways helps, or I don't know if you to use the verb help, but makes harder the assimilation pattern because people are still always in contact with first generation, particularly in the community. Sometimes the pattern of assimilation, like the Italian or Irish, as soon as the new immigrants stop coming, then the second and third generation assimilates easier. But as we are still having a large number of new immigrants coming, this make. And the second thing is that there are tons of books on how this generation is considered the rejected generation. They are Americans. Second generation born here are Americans. And third generation, but we still call them Hispanics or Mexican Americans. They are Americans, but the way they look, the profiling with, so in certain ways this doesn't help to make them Americans as other communities because they are still, in many cases, they are still treated as immigrants and they are as Americans as you in certain ways. I mean, so for this generation, and this is why it's so interesting for churches to address the bilingual worship services. Because this could be a wonderful resource to reach out this generation, particularly because they speak English. So you can ask the question, if the growing numbers of Hispanics speak English, and for most of them, English is their first language, why a bilingual service? And it's because of culture. Language and culture are come together, and in a certain way is welcoming these people that have not been so welcome in the country generally speaking. So they, and because they still are linked to the first generation and to the Hispanic, larger Hispanic community. So bilingual worship is an opportunity, a missional opportunity for the church to bring the communities together and to serve the bilingual growing population. And when I say bringing the two communities together, it's precisely these families that are mixed, the first and the second generation, and also the changes in our neighborhood. It's a way, if you are in a neighborhood that are experiencing this change is we can build bridges. And we are in a very sensitive time in the country with all what happened with racism, where churches, and we need to speak loud about reconciliation, about building bridges among all different kind of communities. So there are objections. Huh? We talk about the toddlers with vegetables. It's so confusing. Confusing is mostly for those who are monolingual. So these all words in the other language. It is boring. This is the complaint of those who are bilingual, because everything is said in the two languages. Is this distracting? Moving. Distraction for those, the complaint is more about switching from one language to the other. It requires a lot of work, which is completely true. And some people say it's not authentic. Worship with words I don't understand. So these are some of the, probably you have more, but these are some of the more most common objections. So what I want to share with you is a kind of recipe. Yeah.
I'm sorry, but before you move to a new area, I was in a church in Tucson, Arizona, mm-hmm. and we were starting a Spanish service, and the pastor asked some of the people in the parish who were bilingual to move from the English service to the Spanish-speaking service to help get it started. And they objected. They preferred to worship in English. Have you encountered that?
Yes. There are all kind of reasons. And some of them is because they say, well, it's too boring for me going back and forth. Some others, and in the history of Hispanics in this country, in different states, is also different. In some cases, people are ashamed of being identified as Hispanics, and they try to assimilate as fast as they can. So you have to deal with all these issues. I lived in Florida. Cubans in Florida are so proud of Hispanic heritage, but it's not the same in the other coast, when people were bound to speak Spanish. So there are different realities in the country. And again, and it is much more complex, that Hispanics are not a culture. We just share a common language. And even, I was telling, in my country, the Italian immigration was so strong that I come from Argentina, we are the one who speak Spanish with Italian accent. And the other Spanish make fun of us, the way we pronounce some words. Sure. So when I'm simplifying when I say Hispanic, because it's completely different to plan a worship service if you are with Cuban and Americans or with Mexican and Americans, or if you have a Hispanic community of 17 different nationalities that happen in many states where Hispanics are around, but yeah, we have some things in common, but we don't have the same food, we don't speak the language the same way, music, completely different, the Caribbean, Central America, and we South Americans. And so there are much more complexity to the picture. Just trying to, so in this sense, different histories make that for some Hispanics, they are very attached to the culture, and they want their kids to learn Spanish, and they want to keep the family in the culture and the tradition. Other Hispanics speak English to the kids, and they try them to assimilate to have more success in this society. So different patterns too. That's why I brought this recipe that is borrowed, it's not mine. I just adapted, as you do with all recipes in cooking, and you can take whatever it could help you and add your own things, because each context in the country, in this country, is different. So the first thing I would recommend is having a bilingual celebrant or a team, if you don't have someone that is bilingual, but with excellent speaker, an excellent speaker in each language. And I was telling this to someone. It's hard. For instance, I can preach in... I prefer preaching in Spanish. I can preach in English. But I never do the two things at the same time. I think, but in my perspective, it's confusing for people. you just say 2-3 words and then switch. My preference is having two different people, two different voices, very fluent in their own language. This is a preference. So, but it's good that people have a good quality of language in each language. Second, great worship aids, bulletins or screen, whatever could make it easier for everybody. Flexibility. It's important to plan, but with these things, we need to have some room for changes. Hospitality. Everybody needs to feel they are welcome. Everybody needs to feel they belong to the church. That's not the Anglo community opening to the Hispanics or the Hispanics. Now we are starting inviting the Anglos because our kids are starting speaking English. So the fact that we are a community together. Some things, not most things, need to be done in the two languages. All kind of instruction, Bible reading from the gospel, of course the sermon, prayers, the intercession prayers, and announcements at least. And then the other things, you can make an option for one language or the other, or a combination with one Sunday you can do it on a language and the other Sunday in another language.
That's the way my pastor does.
Right.
And sometimes he just says everybody speak their own language.
Right.
And we do the Nicene Creed or the Lord's Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes he'll say, we'll do the Lord's Prayer in Spanish today. And some Sundays,
right.
You know, he's very creative.
And we can put always in the screen or in the bulletin the other language so people know what's going on.
We have it in the bulletin, both
right.
languages.
Work on the sermon. We are, in our tradition, our worship service is sermon-oriented. So sermon is a big piece, almost half of the time of a worship service. Work on the sermon. The sermon needs to communicate well to the attendees. And in this sense, it's important, if you are using a translator, to use someone that is preaching in the other language. Not just translating. And I'm talking about the style of communication. doesn't mean that the other needs to be a preacher,
right.
But needs to translate, respecting all the communication style of a sermon. And being culturally sensitive in translation. There are some jokes and examples that make sense for one community and perhaps not for the other. Here it's a good example. Marisa Galvan wrote an article on how to translate a sermon where the Anglo preacher was talking about Oprah. And in the translation, the translator mentioned Cristina. Cristina is like the Oprah of the Latinos in Peru. So perhaps if
telenovelas? Telenovelas?
You know, Cristina is a talk show.
Oh, Cristina.
Yeah. So it's important for people to make sense with jokes, particularly things that are very Anglo in the Anglo culture. But for other people, perhaps that doesn't make sense. And the opposite.
Yes.
If the main preacher is preaching in Spanish and making reference to food or to music or whatever that is very related to the Hispanic community. Try everything before you consider headphones. Translation through headphones. Because it's like saying, well, you are second class. This is a Hispanic service, and if you don't understand Spanish, you just go to the headphones and someone will translate just for you or for those of you who do not understand. It works for the two communities. It's important when in the planning, particularly to think in those who are monolingual. And this is a good advice for those who are bilingual. Try to think as if you were not bilingual. What happens with just people that just understand Spanish or just understand English? And a good exercise, if you are bilingual, is going to other kind of bilingual service, English, Korean, or English, Chinese, or whatever, and experience how hard it is if you don't know the two languages. limit the total number of words. Mm-hmm. It's too long, a service translated and going back and forth. So, and this is linked to the other idea that we can explore the use of nonverbal symbols and actions. Not everything needs to be done in words. We are new in Kentucky. We moved recently, and so this is the stage where we are visiting many churches. And we visited one church that I really liked, that they do this time of, they call it recognizing the sacred space. And so they do different things that requires movement. And this, in one case, was, well, everybody went to the windows where there were candles, and everybody had to light a candle. And it was so nice, huh? not only the symbolism of the presence of the Holy Spirit there, but also involving movement. This is something that does not require words, that everybody could understand, and we can experience this kind of nonverbal actions. And developed a shared music repertoire. And this is, you can do many things with songs, but we have an expert here that is Mr. Bob Battestini. So I will ask him to continue with this.
Yes, one more possibility for the recipe.
Oh, wonderful.
And that is that it is really strategic to have representatives of both groups in worship leadership positions. The ones up front, visible, in the choir, the readers, the ushers, the people who are leading the worship. It is utterly important to have representatives of both groups represented in those leadership roles. I really think that's another important.
Absolutely. Recipe. So you can add this. Mm-hmm. And if you have any other, we can ask Bob to move to this part on music, and then we come back with some questions, and if you have some other suggestions that could help our brothers and sisters that are working with this, are welcome.
Thank you, Maria. I am Bob Battestini. I'm the retired senior editor, vice president of GIA Publications, and I moved from Chicago to West Michigan. I joined a parish, I'm Roman Catholic, I joined a parish in Holland, Michigan, which is 55% Hispanic, all Mexican, and 45% Anglo. Actually, there's about 2% Vietnamese in there, too. I would add one more thing to this list, but a recipe. Good bilingual liturgy is also going to take a little longer, especially if you're in a ritual church, such as I am, where you have to follow the ritual. It's going to take a little longer. And I think if you do it well, the folks are okay with that. My parish experienced the first immigrants in the 1950s. They came as migrant workers to work in this orchard country. Over a period of time, the influx kept growing and growing and growing until, like I say today, the church is 55% Mexican, but it's not because the Anglos have left. The church has just grown that much. About 25 years ago, we had a pastor who was really concerned with, before I precede that, typical in this situation is two communities using the same building. They are two churches, often with separate clergy. They use the same building. One church is St. Mary's, the other calls it Santa Maria. That's as far as we're. 25 years ago, we had the first pastor who was bilingual, and he made efforts toward bringing the two communities together. And there were little ways it was done. He was replaced about 12 years ago by our current pastor, Father Charlie Brown, who is also bilingual, fluently bilingual. And I would say one comment here about different leaders. Our pastor, even if we have a Hispanic priest visiting, he still insists on leading the liturgies because he wants to be pastor to the whole parish, to both communities. So he is the pastor that everybody knows. And, we have this process in Catholic Church called con-celebration. If there is a visiting priest from Mexico or from South America, he will con-celebrate, but still the liturgy is presided over by our pastor because he insists that he had that relationship. 5-10 years ago, we started an effort of trying to do the last thing there, number 12, develop a shared music repertoire. And we have been taking baby steps, and I'm going to share what we do now. First of all, in full disclosure, this is a book when my GIA days I had something to do with. We got a pressure to publish a bilingual hymnal, and I said, well, we're going to do a bilingual hymnal. It should be bilingual for parishes that are multicultural, Anglo, Latino, and this is the book we did. Right now we're working on a Protestant version with the Calvin Institute folks. But my parish adopted this book 2 years ago, and while a book is just a tool, purely a tool, it has enabled us to do some things that we were never able to do before. So these are some of the baby steps we are taking. You should be books around here on the table. Way to the back of the book at 894. Being a ritual church, we sing a psalm every Sunday as part of the liturgy of the word. This happens to be the psalm from Pentecost. Lord, send out your spirit. This is typical of basically 894. Wait a minute. This is very typical of some of what we do. Now, this one has both the Spanish and the English refrain with essentially the same melody. The Cantor would say, Envía tu Espíritu, Señor, y renueva la faz de la tierra. And then everybody would repeat it. Let's do that. Ready? And Envía tu Espíritu, Señor, y renueva la faz de la tierra. Lord, send out your Spirit and renew the face of the earth. Start the Spanish, then go right to the English. Ready, and. Well, I really did that well, considering I didn't have my music classes on. All right, we do one Mass in Spanish on Sunday. We have three in English or bilingual. We would do this refrains this way at all the Masses, both languages. It self-translates. So you don't have people singing words they don't know, because when you do these duplicated things, they self-translate. At the Spanish Mass, the verses to the psalm would be sung. This is Psalm 104. The verses to the psalm would be sung in Spanish. At the English Mass, they would be sung in English. But we still, the whole community is at least singing the same refrain. All right, let's look at another one. Go to number 837.
Excuse me, so do you sing the refrain twice each time you do it?
Yes, we do. We do it twice. We double it. Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. Okay, in this type. Now, here's a little different type, though. 837. Psalm 23. In fact, I think you're going to sing this in worship tonight or tomorrow.
El Señor es mi pastor, nada me falta. El Señor es mi pastor, nada me falta.
Together.
El Señor es mi pastor.
Or you can do this in psalm entirely in English.
The Lord is my shepherd, there is nothing I shall want. The Lord is my shepherd, nothing shall I fear.
The Lord is my shepherd.
Okay, you get the idea. Half the room sing Spanish, half the room sing English. Ready? 2, 3. Now I'm not going to pretend
pretend for a minute that we are to the point yet where we divide the church in half and say, you sing Spanish, you sing English. But what we will often do, well, first of all, here's the way we actually do this piece. And I gave it to you. I'm showing you this because many of the refrains in our repertoire do this. Here's the way we sing this.
El Señor es mi pastor, nada me falta. The Lord is my shepherd, nothing shall I fear.
So you half Spanish, half English. A lot of the refrains work that way. But you do have the possibility. Now, if we were going to do both together, here's what I would do. We would be doing it in one language with the congregation. I would have half the choir about the third time through. I would have the half the choir support the congregation, and the other half do the other language. So we get it becomes a desk camp. That's the way we use these. All right, one third time I want to show you. We don't have really enough time. It's the same kind of approach, slightly different. Let's go on and go to number 202. Service music. We have a fixed liturgy, of course. This is one of the settings we use. It's the one we use on the bigger feast days, the Christmas season and the Easter season. At all liturgies, whether they be in Spanish or English, we do the glory of this. We do the refrain this way.
Glory to God in the highest. Glory to God in the highest. And on earth, peace to people of good will. Gloria a Dios en el cielo. Gloria a Dios en el cielo.
Every time we do the refrain, we do it twice, we do it in both languages. At the English Masses, then the verses are done in English. At the Spanish verse, Mass, the verses. But what this succeeds in doing, and like I said, these are baby steps, it reminds the Mexican community that they're part of a multicultural bilingual parish. It reminds the Anglo community that they're part of a multicultural bilingual parish. And everything we've been doing lately, almost everything we're doing, is self-translating. So at no point are we angering people because we're forcing them to sing something they don't grasp. Look, I'll show you. 206, just turn up page. Here's the Santo, Santo, Santo. Again, it can be done all in Spanish, it can be done all in English, but at every liturgy in our church, we do the bilingual version.
Holy, 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 Lord God of hosts. Heaven and earth are full of your glory. Santo, Santo, Santo es el Señor Dios del Universo.
And that's what we do every Sunday. Both languages, self-translating. Nobody gets upset. And I'll show you a very beautiful piece. I just absolutely love it. 212. I'm going to make you sing this one.
All right, 212 be in this book.
First time in, I can't multitask, I'm too old for that now. First time in Spanish, second time in English, third final time in, what did I say, what number? 212, okay, got it. First time in Spanish.
Thank you.
singing it that way. All right, let's look at hymns 364. This is actually a Hebrew melody, but it comes through the Hispanic community. I think it appeared first in Hispanic. With hymns like this, we use this hymn in our church during the Advent season as a communion song. And with communion takes an awfully long time. The liturgy says communion songs are, our rubrics say communion songs should either be about bread or wine or should be about the season. So we do an Advent hymn during this time. Because communion takes so long, we'll actually sing all 10 stanzas. We do 5 in Spanish and then 5 in English. There are enough people who have had 2 years of high school Spanish that they manage to negotiate the Spanish. And we always do the refrain doubly in both languages. So even if it's a lightly attended service where we may only sing the verses in English, the refrain is always done in both languages. Let me find the accompaniment to this. This is a lovely hymn. It's amazing. Last session, the last hour, we had a much bigger crowd, and they sang much more poorly. You're doing
it. Is that true?
Songs in this book, lots of them, and we do them all that way. Now this song, I say we do the whole thing, but many of them you're only going to be able to do it once through, but we'll always double the refrain, and we always do it in both languages. It again is self-translating. Everybody's happy with it. I have another one. I didn't do this in the last session, but I want to do this because it's such a lovely hymn, and it's from Argentina. By my good friend Pablo Sosa, who has been here many times. I gotta find it in the index here. Okay, number 782. 782. This is a lovely Lenten hymn. And we have, because it is so short, we always do all the stanzas. We sing both languages. So how about if we'll just do one stanza in, how about 1 and 2 in Spanish, 3 and 4 in English? It's worth singing this whole text.
Oh,
Pablo Sosa. Interesting story to this hymn. The text was originally written in English. He loved it so much he translated it to Spanish, wrote this tune. Then later somebody wrote a new English translation from the Spanish. This is not the original text, although I think the original author is still credited. Look at 428 very quickly. Thinking about multicultural. Anglos like to sing spirituals, and we've learned that Latinos do too. So there's a fair amount of, we do a few things like this, where we'll sing them again. We'll mix up the languages, do them anyway. That works. Look at 406. This is just a little show and tell. Now we're not going to really sing all these, but here's a hymn by contemporary composer Marty Howden. It's a Lenten hymn, and it again we do it the same way. We'll always double the refrain. Return to God with all your heart, the source of grace and mercy. Come seek the tender faithfulness of God. Volvamos, let's do the Spanish together. Ready to end.
Volvamos hoy a nuestro Dios, Señor de toda gracia, buscando su perdón y libertad.
Now the time of grace has come, the day of salvation. Come learn, come and learn, come learn. I don't remember the melody. Come and learn how the way of our God.
And then we do the refrain again, both languages. We do that. One of the things, a comment I made in last session, and I just want to make it again now. It's obvious to you, I'm not a Spanish speaker, I'm not bilingual. I'm part of the Anglo community that is working hard on trying to become, on this process of trying to make one parish out of this community. I think if you want to do a workshop in your community, you might want to do a workshop on pronunciation for Anglos. Mm. Now, if the translation is in the book, you don't have to teach them vocabulary and go into grammar but you could do a pronunciation. I mean, it's difficult, especially when it's hyphenated like this, and then in a songbook you get words with elisions. Do a workshop on pronunciation. Take a couple of hymns that are well known, someone who is a good Spanish speaker, and just drill the folks on pronunciation and have them read. I mean, that is a very, very valuable workshop. And you can even, if it catches on in your community, you might do it every season of the year, you know. We're going to have our fall workshop on some of the hymns that we're going to introduce. If you want to come, we'll come and help, you know, and you can do the same for the Hispanics who don't speak English. You can do a workshop on English pronunciation. 757. I'm just sort of, everything I'm doing here is stuff we do in our parish. So that's all I'm giving you. I'm giving you a little walk through the kind of baby steps we're taking. But it's I can say with absolute truthfulness that all of this is working. And there's very, very little kickback of any kind from anybody. And part of it is because we're not jamming it down anybody's throats. It's going slow. They're baby steps. And we've always made sure that we do everything in a way that will succeed. There's nothing worse than the piano plays and nobody sings, you know, or the piano plays and the person on the microphone is the only one you hear singing. We're a Catholic parish. Now, I maybe shouldn't say this here in Reformed country, but we're a Catholic parish that sings like a bunch of Methodists. I mean, we really do raise the roof. And if the song isn't working, we know it's not working, and we know we're not doing something right, because we also sing the liturgy. And when the pastor sings, "The Lord be with you," the congregation answers, unfortunately, and with your spirit. And a sound comes across the church like a tsunami. I mean, the people are so vocally responsive. It's just overwhelming. Here's a song by... a communion song by the composer Michael Jonkis, the guy who wrote Eagle's Wings. Hey, let's just sing it. Let's do the refrain twice. Ready? Go.
Hey,
up with joy.
And we go back. Now, you can use two cantors. Again, I echo what you said. Two cantors, one who is a native Spanish speaker, one who's a native, and alternate the verses back and forth. Congregation always hear. Sometimes the choir does the verses on something like this, too. I'm going to show you a dream. We don't do this yet, but this is what I hope we're going to be doing very soon. 5:14. You take a well-known hymn like this. It's known to every person in the world knows this tune. My dream is that one day we'll just simply tell people in our congregation. Now, people do this already. I've heard it done at Tizay. I've been to Tizay a number of times. I've heard it done there. My dream is that one of these days people in our congregation will feel comfortable enough to sing in their own language simultaneously. I know it can be done. We just haven't. I haven't convinced the pastor or the music director yet to make that step. So we haven't stood up and told, and you know, people have to be given permission. We haven't given them permission yet, but I think this is the next step to take it. I'm going to do a little experiment with you, because I see you all going, yes, I don't have to convince you, but I love to do this experiment with people. Patricia, 380, I'm sorry, I'm turning to a page, I haven't told you what it is. Okay, I need some volunteers to sing in English. Who wants to sing in English? We got a few English speakers. Guys, come on. We got a couple of people singing English. Okay, good. I was saying Spanish. Spanish? Okay, come on. A couple more Spanish speakers. Okay, and then and anybody who's left singing Latin. Here we go. 1, 2, 3. When you tell some people to do this, they go, oh, you've got to be kidding, that's cacophony. It's cacophony if there's an audience. But congregational singing, there is no audience. Everybody sings. And you hear yourself. You just got the experience right now. You heard yourself. You heard everything around you, but you hear yourself first. So if you're a Spanish speaker and you're going to sing in Spanish while all the people around you are singing in English, it works. I had this experience at Tizay once. I was there in October, and it was all filled with Germans. There were like 900 of them. There was a holiday, school holiday, and they were all young people with their chaperones from Germany. I think I was the only English speaker in the room, or at least the only one singing in English. And I sang in English the whole time. I also did some singing in German after a while, you know. But when I was singing in English and everybody around me was singing in German, it felt perfectly. It was like being surrounded by an orchestra. Now, I imagine if you are bilingual and you're equal in both languages, it may be more confusing. I don't speak German, so the Germans around me were like instruments. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't confusing to me at all. All right, I mentioned Tizay, so we're going to end with a little bit of Tizay. 7:06. This is something else we do in our church with great, great success. These little refrains, these little asana. By the way, that in the Lord I'll be everything. That's Isaiah also, and it's in here in both languages.
7:06.
Jesus, ready, get set, go.
Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom.
Spanish.
Jesus, recuérdame cuando entres en tu reino.
We do a lot of this with these Tizay type things. We just keep alternating. We may sing it through six times, and we just alternate English, Spanish, English, Spanish, English, Spanish. Everybody gets on board. The charism in the room is just overwhelming, and it becomes the one. There's lots of little things like that available. The Tizay music is full of
fact, that there's a new collection, I think, just out of today's music that is primarily a Spanish collection. Any questions? We've got a couple minutes. Of either Maria or I. Comments?
Yeah. The worship director at a church that's doing bilingual ministry right now, and our song selection is generally more contemporary than, you know, you said this is a contemporary piece and it was written in 1950.
But The Ode to Joy was written in 1780.
No, I totally understand what you're saying.
I know what you're talking about.
But for, say, yeah, I mean, we're doing Hillsong stuff, which is written in English, translated into Spanish, and one of the biggest voices that I hear is we need to sing Latino songs. And yeah, I guess where can I find Latino songs that are contemporary?
Oh, contemporary. I have no idea.
Okay.
I really don't know.
Is that happening?
Well, I come from a great Spanish town. We do Hillsong Spanish and English.
Right.
And there have been special occasions where we've done both kind of this one version in English, one version in Spanish, maybe the chorus in English. But we do have some Spanish songs. I grew up in Spanish church, so there are some worship songs that are in Spanish. And I don't know if I can get you. Maybe I get you email and send you some.
Absolutely.
Some artists.
Yeah. Nashville has a large industry.
There is
Spanish
language.
I work at Baker Book House. We're having a lot more people coming in asking for Spanish books, music, Bibles, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we have
some. There as well.
There you go. Anybody else? Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Pleasure working with you.
Oh, thank you.
Gotcha.